Chapter 31. In the corridor, her necromancer was staring distantly down the passageway at the disappearing hems of the third. Her brow had furrowed a wrinkle into her paint. Gideon had intended to... She had intended to do a lot of things, but Hero left her no opening for the actions she'd planned and offered none of the answers she'd wanted. She simply turned in a swish of black cloth and said, "Follow me." Gideon had prepared beforehand a fuck you salvo so long and so loud that Hero would have to be taken away to be killed, but then Hero added, "Please?" This please convinced Gideon to follow her in silence. She had more or less expected Hero to lead with, "What were you doing in my closet?" At which point, Gideon might well have shaken her until the teeth in her head and the teeth in her pockets all rattled. Hero Harks swept down the stairs two at a time, the treads creaking in panic as they went down the grand flight that led them to the atrium. From there, down one corridor, down another, one left, and then down the steps to the training rooms. Hero ignored the tapestry that would have taken them to the hidden corridor and the ransacked Lictor laboratory where Jean-Marie had died, and instead pushed open the big dark doors to the pool. Once there, she tossed down two grubby knuckles from her pockets. A substantial skeleton sprang from each, unfurling. They stood before the door, linked elbows, and held it shut. She scattered another handful of chips like pale grain. Skeletons rose, forming and expanding the bone as though bubbling up from it. They made themselves a perimeter around the whole room, pressing the knobbles of their spines against the old ceramic tile and standing to attention. Shoulder to shoulder they stood, as though bodyguards or hideous chaperones. Hera turned to face Gideon, and her eyes were as black and inexorable as a gravity collapse. "The time has come." She took a deep breath, and then she undid the catches to her robes, and they fell away from her thin shoulders to puddle around her ankles on the floor. "To tell you everything," she said.
"Oh, thank God for that," said Gideon hysterically, profoundly embarrassed at how her heart rate had spiked.
"Shut up and get in the pool." This was so unanticipated that she didn't bother to question or to complain or even to hesitate. Gideon unhooked her robe and hood and pulled off her shoes, unstrapped her rapier and the belt that held her gauntlet. Hera seemed ready to enter the greenly lapping waves wearing her trousers and shirt, so Gideon figured, "Oh well, what the hell," and made the plunge almost fully clothed. She jumped in recklessly. Tidal waves exploded outward at her passing, peppering the stone sides of the pool with droplets gushing and foaming. The seamy, distasteful feeling of water seeping through her underwear hit her all at once. Gideon spluttered and ducked her head beneath and spat out a mouthful of liquid that was warm as blood. After a moment's consideration, Hero stepped in too, walking off the side carelessly, slipping beneath the water like a clean black knife. She disappeared beneath the surface, then emerged, gasping, spluttering in a way that ruined everything about the portentous entrance. She faced Gideon and trod water, flapping her arms a little before she managed to get her toes touching the bottom.
"Are we in here for a reason?"
Their voices echoed. "The ninth house has a secret, Nav," said Hero. She sounded calm and measured and frank in a way she'd never been before. "Only my family knows of it. And even we could never discuss it, unless, this was my mother's rule, we were immersed in salt water. We kept a ceremonial pool for the purpose, hidden from the rest of the house. It was cold and deep, and I hated every moment I was in it. But my mother is dead, and I find now that, if I really am to betray my family's most sacred trust, I am obliged at the least to keep intact her rule." Gideon blinked.
"Oh, shit," she said. "You really meant it. This is it. This is go time."
"This is go time," agreed Harrowhark. Gideon swept both of her hands through her hair, trickles going down the back of her neck and into her sodden collar. Eventually, all she said was, "Why?"
"The reasons are multitudinous," said her necromancer.
Her paint was wearing off in the water. She looked like a grey picture of a melting skeleton.
"I had intended to let you know some of it before, an expurgated version. And then you looked in my closet. If I had told you my suspicions about Septimus's meat puppet on the first day, none of this would have happened."
"The first day?"
"Griddle," said Harrow, "I have not puppeted my own parents around for 5 years and learned nothing."
Anger did seep into Gideon then, along with a couple more litres of salt water.
"Why the hell didn't you tell me when you killed him?"
"I didn't kill him," said Harrowhark sharply. "Someone else did. Blade through the heart, from what I saw. Though I only got a few minutes to look before I had to run. I only had to push the theorem the most basic bit before he came apart. I took the head and left when I thought I heard someone coming. This was the night after we completed the entropy field challenge."
"No, you monster's ass," said Gideon coldly. "I mean, why didn't you tell me you'd killed him before you sent Jean-Marie Chateur and her necromancer down to the facility to look for the guy who was in a box in your closet? Why didn't you take the moment to say, I don't know, let's not send two children downstairs to get fucked up by a huge bone creature?"
Harrow exhaled. "I panicked," she said. "At the time, I thought I was sending you down a blind tunnel and that the real danger was Sextus and Septimus, that either one might ambush you, and that the sensible solution was to take them both on myself. My plan was to get you clear of a necromantic duel. At the time, I even thought it elegant."
"Nona Jezimus, all you had to do was delay. Tell me you were freaking out. All you had to do was say that Dulcinea's calf was a mummy man."
"I had reason to believe," said Harrow, "that you would trust her more than you trusted me."
This answer contorted Gideon's face into her best, "Are you fucking kidding me?" expression. Opposite, Harrow smoothed her forehead out with her thumbs, which took away another significant portion of skeleton.
"I thought you were compromised," she continued waspishly. "I assumed you would assume that I dismantled the puppet as an act of bad faith and go straight to the Seventh. I wanted to do enough research to present you with a cut-and-dry case. I had no idea what it would mean for the Fourth House. The Ninth is deep in their blood debt, and I am undone by the expense. I did not want to hurt you, Griddle. I didn't want to disturb your equilibrium."
"Harrow," said Gideon, "if my heart had a dick, you would kick it."
"I did not want to alienate you more than I already had. And then it seemed as though we were on a more even footing," said Harrow, who was stumbling in a way Gideon had never before witnessed. It looked as though she were ransacking drawers in her brain, trying to find the right set of words to wear.
It was too tenuous to risk, and then..."
"Too tenuous to risk?"
"Harrow," said Gideon again, more slowly, "if I hadn't gone to Palamedes, and I nearly didn't go to Palamedes, I would have waited for you in our rooms with my sword drawn, and I would have gone for you. I was so convinced you were behind everything, that you'd killed Jean-Marie and Isaac, Magnus and Abigail."
"I didn't. I never have," said Harrow. "And I know."
"You would have killed me.
Or vice versa."
This surprised her into silence. The wavelets sploshed gently at the tiled edges of the pool. Gideon kicked off the bottom and fluttered her feet back and forth, bobbing, her shirt billowing out with water.
"Okay," she said eventually. "Question time. Who did all the murders?"
"Nav,
I mean it. What's happening? Is Canaan House haunted or what? What? Who killed the Fourth and the Fifth?"
Her necromancer also pulled her feet up from the bottom and floated, momentarily, chin deep in green salt water. Her eyes were narrowed in thought.
I can't say, she said. Sorry, that's not a fruitful line of inquiry. We are being pursued by revenants, or it's all part of the challenge, or one or more of us is picking off the others. The murders of the 5th and the 4th may be connected, or not. The bone fragments found in everyone's wounds don't match, naturally, but I believe their very particle formation points to the same type of necromantic construction, no matter what Sexta says about topological resonance and skeletal archetype theory.
Harrow, don't make me drown myself.
My conclusion. If the murders are linked, and if some adept, rather than a revenant force or the facility itself, is behind the construct you saw, then it is one of us, said Harrow. We're the only living beings in Kanan House. That means the suspect list is the Tridentarii, Sextus, Octokaiseron, the Second, or myself. And I haven't discounted Teacher and the Priests. Septimus has something of an alibi.
Yes, being nearly dead, said Gideon.
Harrowhark said, rather grudgingly. I've downgraded her in some respects. Logically, judging by ability and mind and the facility to combine both in service to an end, it's Palamedes Sextus and his cavalier. She shook her head as Gideon opened her mouth to protest. No, I realise neither has, as you might put it, a fucking motive. A logical conclusion is worth very little if I don't have all the facts. Then there's Teacher, and the Lictor laboratories, and the rules. Why those theorems? What powers them? Why was the 4th Cavalier killed, but you left alive?
These were all questions that Gideon had privately asked the dead of night many times since Jean-Marie had died. She let her shoulders slide back into the water until it was cold up to the backs of her ears, staring at the single fluorescing bar that swung above the pool. Her body floated weightless in a puddle of yellow light. She could have asked Harrow anything. She could have asked about the bomb that had taken Ortus Nigenad's life instead of hers, or she could have asked about her whole entire existence, why it had happened and for what reason. Instead, she found herself asking, "What do you know about the conditioner pathogen that bumped off all the kids, the one that happened when I was little, before you were born?" The silence was terrible. It lasted for such a long time that she wondered if Hera had slyly drowned herself in the interim until... "It didn't happen before I was born," said the other girl, sounding very unlike herself. "Or at least, that's not precise enough. It happened before I was even conceived."
"That's unwholesomely specific. It's important. My mother needed to carry a child to term, and that child needed to be a necromancer to fill the role of true heir to the locked tomb. But as necromancers themselves, they found the process doubly difficult. We hardly had access to the fetal care technology that the other houses do. She had tried and failed already. She was getting old. She had one chance, and she couldn't afford chance."
Gideon said, "You can't just control whether or not you're carrying a necro."
"Yes, you can," said Harrow, "if you have the resources and are willing to pay the price of using them."
The hairs on the back of Gideon's neck rose wetly.
"Harrow," she said slowly, "by resources, are you saying..."
200 children, said Harrowhark tiredly, "from the ages of 6 weeks to 18 years. They needed to all die more or less simultaneously for it to work. My great-aunts measured out the organophosphates after weeks of mathematics. Our house pumped them through the cooling system."
From somewhere beneath the pool, a filter made blurting sounds as it recycled the spill-off. Harrow said,
"The infants alone generated enough thanergy to take out the entire planet. Babies always do, for some reason."
Gideon couldn't hear this. She held her knees to the chest and let herself go under just for a moment. The water sluiced over her head and through her hair. Her ears roared, then popped. When she pushed above the surface again, the noise of her heartbeat thumping through her skull was like an explosion.
"Say something," said Harrowhark. Gross, said Gideon dully. Ick, the worst. What can I say to that? What the fuck can I say to all that?
It let me be born, said the necromancer, and I was me. And I have been aware since I was very young about how I was created. I am exactly 200 sons and daughters of my house, Griddle. I am the whole generation of the ninth. I came into this world a necromancer at the expense of Dreaber's future, because there is no future without me.
Gideon's stomach churned, but her brain was more urgent than her nausea. Why leave me, though? She demanded. They murdered the rest of the house, but they left me off the list?
There was a pause.
We didn't, said Harrow.
What?
You were meant to die, Griddle, along with all the others. You inhaled nerve gas for 10 full minutes. My great-aunts went blind just from releasing it, and you weren't affected, even though you were just 2 cots away from the vent. You just didn't die. My parents were terrified of you for the rest of their lives.
The Reverend Father and Mother hadn't found her unnatural because of how she'd been born. They'd found her unnatural because of how she hadn't died. And all the nuns and all the priests and all the anchorites of the cloister had taken the cue from them, not knowing that it was because Gideon was just some smothered and unfortunate animal who had still been alive the next day. The world revolved as Harrow floated closer. Memory took Pelliamina's steady gaze and refocused the way it slid through and over Gideon from contempt to dread. It took the stentorious, short-changed breath when Priamhark saw her and breathed it again in horror, not in repugnance. One small kid who, to 2 adults, was a walking reminder of the day they had chosen to mortgage the future of their house. No wonder she had hated the huge, dark doors of Dreaber. Beyond that portal lurked the used-up, emptied-out shades of a bunch of kids whose main sin in life was that they'd been good batteries.
"And do you think you're worth it?" she asked bluntly.
Next to her, Harrow didn't flinch. "If I became a lictor," she said meditatively, "and renewed my house, and made it great again, and greater than it ever was, and justified its existence in the eyes of God the Emperor, if I made my whole life a monument to those who died to ensure that I would live and live powerfully."
Gideon waited.
"Of course I wouldn't be worth it," Harrow said scornfully. "I'm an abomination. The whole universe ought to scream whenever my feet touch the ground. My parents committed a necromantic sin that we ought to have been torpedoed into the centre of Dominicus for. If any of the other houses knew of what we'd done, they would destroy us from orbit without a second's thought. I am a war crime."
She stood up. Gideon watched as sheets of seawater slicked down her shoulders, her hair a wet black cap on her skull, her skin sheening grey and green from the waves. All the paint had rubbed off, and Harrowhark looked thin and haggard and no older than Jean-Marie Chateau.
"But I'd do it again," said the war crime. "I'd do it again if I had to. My parents did it because there was no other way, and they didn't even know. I had to be a necromancer of their bloodline, Nav, because only a necromancer can open the locked tomb. Only a powerful necromancer can roll away the stone. I found that only the perfect necromancer can pass through those wards and live and approach the sarcophagus."
Gideon's toes found purchase, and she stood chest deep in water, goosebumped all over from the cold.
"What happened to praying that the tomb be shut forever and the rock never be rolled away?"
"My parents didn't understand either. And that's why they died," said Harrowhark. "That's why, when they knew I'd done it, that I'd rolled away the stone, and that I'd gone through the monument, and that I had seen the place where the body was buried, they thought I'd betrayed God. The locked tombs meant to house the one true enemy of the King Undying, Nav, Something older than time, the cost of the resurrection, the beast that he defeated once but can't defeat twice. The abyss of the first, the death of the Lord. He left the grave with us for our safekeeping, and he trusted the ones who built the tomb a myriad ago to wall themselves up with the corpse and die there. But we didn't. And that's how the ninth house was made.
Gideon remembered Silas Octocizeron. The eighth never forgot that the ninth was never meant to be.
Are you telling me that when you were 10 years old, 10 years old, you busted the lock on the tomb, broke into an ancient grave and made your way past hideous old magic to look at a dead thing, even though your parents told you it'd start the apocalypse?
Yes, said Hera Hark.
Why?
There was another pause, and Hera looked down into the water. Limned by electric light, her pupils and her irises appeared the same colour.
I was tired of being 200 corpses, she said simply. I was old enough to know how monstrous I was. I had decided to go and look at the tomb, and if I didn't think it was worth it, to go up the stairs, all the flights of the ninth house, open up an airlock, and walk. And walk.
She lifted her gaze. She held Gideon's.
But you came back instead, said Gideon. I'd told the Reverend Mother and the Reverend Father what I'd seen you do. I killed your parents.
What? My parents killed my parents. I should know.
But I told them.
My parents killed themselves because they were frightened and ashamed, said Hera tightly. They thought it was the only honourable thing to do.
I think your parents must have been frightened and ashamed for a hell of a long time.
I'm not saying I didn't blame you. I did. It was much easier. I pretended for a long time that I could have saved them by talking to them and Mortis the Ninth. When you walked in, when you saw what you saw, when you saw what I had failed to do, I hated you because you saw what I didn't do. My mother and father weren't angry, Nav. They were very kind to me. They tied their own nooses and then they helped me tie mine. I watched them help Mortis onto the chair. Mortis didn't even question it. He never did. But I couldn't do it. After all I had convinced myself I was ready to do, I made myself watch when my parents... I could not do the slightest thing my house expected of me. Not even then. You're not the only one who couldn't die.
The waves lapped, tiny and quiet, around their clothes and their skins.
Hera, said Gideon, and her voice caught.
Hera, I'm so bloody sorry.
Hera's eyes snapped wide open. The whites blazed like plasma. The black rings were blacker than the bottom of Dreaba. She waded through the water, snatched Gideon's wet shirt in her fists, and shook her with more violence than Gideon had ever thought her muscularly capable of. Her face was livid in its hate. Her loathing was a mortar. It was combustion.
You apologize to me, she bellowed. You apologize to me now. You say that you're sorry when I have spent my life destroying you. You are my whipping girl. I hurt you because it was a relief. I exist because my parents killed everyone and relegated you to a life of abject misery. And they would have killed you too and not given it a second's goddamned thought. I have spent your life trying to make you regret that you weren't dead, all because I regretted I wasn't. I ate you alive, and you have the temerity to tell me that you're sorry.
There were flecks of spittle on Herohark's lips. She was retching for air.
I have tried to dismantle you, Gideon Nav. The ninth house poisoned you. We trod you underfoot. I took you to this killing field as my slave. You refuse to die, and you pity me. Strike me down. You've won. I've lived my whole wretched life at your mercy, yours alone, and God knows I deserve to die at your hand. You are my only friend. I am undone without you.
Gideon braced her shoulders against the weight of what she was about to do. She shared 18 years of living in the dark with a bunch of bad nuns. In the end, her job was surprisingly easy. She wrapped her arms around her own Nona Jesimus and held her long and hard, like a scream. They both went into the water, and the world went dark and salty. The Reverend Daughter fell calm and limp, as was natural for one being ritually drowned. But when she realized that she was being hugged, she thrashed as though her fingernails were being ripped from their beds. Gideon did not let go. After more than one mouthful of saline, they ended up huddled together in one corner of the shadowy pool, tangled up in each other's wet shirt sleeves. Gideon peeled Hera's head off her shoulder by the hair and beheld it, taking her inventory, her point-boned, hateful little face, her woeful black brows, the bloodless bow of her lips. She examined the disdainful set of the jaw, the panic in the starless eyes. She pressed her mouth to the place where Hera's nose met the bone of her frontal sinus, and the sound that Hera made embarrassed them both. "Too many words," said Gideon confidentially. "How about these? One flesh, one end, bitch." The ninth house necromancer flushed nearly black. Gideon tilted her head up and caught her gaze. "Say it, loser."
"One flesh, one end," Hera repeated fumblingly, and then could say no more.
After what seemed like a very, very long time, her adept said,
"Gideon, you need to promise me something."
Gideon wiped a thumb over her temple, tidied away a stringy lock of shadow-coloured hair. Hera shuddered. "I thought that this was all about me getting a bunch of concessions and you grovelling, but you called me Gideon, so shoot."
Hera said, "In the event of my death, Gideon, if something ever does get the better of me, I need you to outlast me. I need you to go back to the ninth house and protect the locked tomb. If I die, I need your duty not to die with me."
"That is such a dick move," said Gideon reproachfully.
"I know," said Hera. "I know.
Hera, what the hell is in there that you'd ask that of me?"
Her adept closed heavy-lidded eyes.
"Beyond the doors, there's just the rock," she said. "The rock and the tomb surrounded by water. I won't bore you with the magic or the locks or the wards or the barriers. Just know that it took me a year to walk 6 steps inside and that it nearly killed me then. There's a blood ward bypass on the doors which will only respond for the necromancer divine. But I knew there had to be an exploit, a way through for the true and devout tomb keeper. I knew in the end it had to open for me. The water's salt, and it's deep, and it moves with a tide that shouldn't exist. The sepulchre itself is small, and the tomb." Her eyes opened. A small, astonished smile creased her mouth. The smile transformed her face into an affliction of beauty that Gideon had heretofore managed to ignore. "The tomb is stone and ice, Nav. Ice that never melts and stone that's even colder. And inside, in the dark, there's a girl."
"A what?"
"A girl, you yellow-eyed moron," said Harrowhark. Her voice dropped to a whisper, and her head was dead weight in Gideon's hands. "Inside the locked tomb is the corpse of a girl. They packed her in ice. She's frozen solid, and they laid a sword on her breast. Her hands are wrapped around the blade. There are chains around her wrists, coming out of her grave, and they go down into holes by each side of the tomb. And there are chains on her ankles that do the same, and there are chains around her throat. Nav, when I saw her face, I decided I wanted to live. I decided to live forever, just in case she ever woke up."
Her voice had the quality of someone in a long dream. She stared through Gideon without looking at her, and Gideon gently took her hands away from Hera's jaw. Instead, she sat back in the water, buoyed by the salt. her eyes starting to sting from it. They both floated there for a long time in amicable silence, until they pulled themselves up and sat, dripping, on the side of the pool. The salt was crusting up their hair. Gideon reached over to take Hera's hand. They sat there, wet through and uncomfortable, fingers curled into each other's in the half-light, the pool interminably lapping at the cool tiles that surrounded it. The skeleton stood in perfect silent ranks, not betraying themselves with even a creak of bone against bone. Gideon's brain moved and broke against itself like the tiny wavelets they had left, the water lurching restlessly from side to side, until it came to a final conclusion. She closed the gap between them a little, until she could see tiny droplets run down the column of Hera's neck and slide beneath her sodden collar. She smelled like ash, even smothered under litres and litres of saline. As she approached, Hera grew very still, and her throat worked, and her eyes opened black and wide. She looked at Gideon without breathing in, her mouth frozen, her hands unmoving, a perfect bone carving of a person. "One last question for you, Reverend Daughter," said Gideon. Hera said, a little unsteadily,
"Nev?"
Gideon leaned in.
"Do you really have the hots for some chilly weirdo in a coffin?"
One of the skeletons punted her back into the water. For all the rest of that evening, they were furtive and unwilling to let the other one out of their sight for more than a minute, as though distance would compromise everything all over again, talking to each other as though they'd never had the opportunity to talk, but talking about bullshit, about nothing at all, just hearing the rise and fall of the other one's voice. That night, Gideon took all her blankets back to the unedifying cavalier bed at the foot of Hera's. When they were both lying in bed in the big, warm dark, Hera's body perpendicular to Gideon's body, Gideon said, "Did you try to kill me back on the 9th? Hera was obviously startled into silence. Gideon pressed. "The shuttle. The one Glorica stole."
"What? No," said Hera. "If you'd gotten on that shuttle, you'd have made it safe to Trentum, I swear by the tomb."
"But Ortus, Sister Glorica."
There was a pause. Her necromancer said, "Were meant to be brought back after 24 hours in disgrace, with Ortus declared unfit to hold his post, relegated to the meanest cloister of the house. Not that Ortus would have minded. We had paid off the pilot."
"Then..."
"Crux claimed," said Hera slowly, "that the shuttle had a fault and blew up en route."
"And you believed him?"
Another pause. Hera said,
"No."
And then,
"Above all else, Nav, he couldn't bear what he saw as disloyalty."
So it was Crux's mean, blackened revenge on his own house, his own zealous desire to burn it clear of any hint of insurrection that had forced Glorica's ghost back to her home planet. She did not say this. Silas Octokizeron knew more than he should, but if Hera discovered that now, she'd be off down the corridor in her nightdress with a sack of emergency bones and a very focused expression.
"What a dope," she said instead. "I was never loyal a day in my life, and I still saw you in the raw."
"Go to sleep, Gideon."
She fell asleep, and for once didn't dream of anything at all.